Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hello, OCD family community. It's Black Friday and quite chilly here in my neck of the woods. But today, we're bringing all the warmth in part 5 of our OCRD series because we're chatting with Dr. Anthony Pinto and friends all about obsessive compulsive personality disorder. And dare I say, I think we're bringing the most hope-filled episode yet. So get cozy, fam, because there's lots of powerful support and strength coming your way.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
All righty. Family. Hello, and happy belated Thanksgiving to everyone who celebrates. I have to admit, Thanksgiving is like the one time of year that I eat turkey. But every time I have it, I remember how much I enjoy it, and I wonder why we don't eat turkey more often. But it's been a busy week, and my little family is decking the halls because my oldest son's birthday is tomorrow, and he enjoys having all of the holly jolly decor out on his special day. So while it's busy, it's never too busy for you, fam, because we are wrapping up the OC-related disorder series, otherwise known as OCRDs, with one of our favorites, Dr. Anthony Pinto, PhD. And this year, Anthony came with a crew of folks, including his OCPD group co-leader, Isabel Siegel, from the Northwell OCD Center, and one of their OCPD group members, Mark. Now, to protect Mark's privacy, we are removing any additional identifying details, but I am confident that you will find his contribution so very helpful. So let me share a little bit more about Anthony for any newer family joining us, and then we'll dive right in. Because we took every moment we could to create better awareness, more understanding, and more hope for OCPD warriors, loved ones, and practitioners. So Dr. Anthony Pinto is the director of the Northwell Health OCD Center at Zucker Hillside Hospital on Long Island and associate professor of psychiatry at the Donald and Barbara Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. Anthony has an extensive publication record with over 100 manuscripts and chapters on OCD and related conditions. He is the leading authority on obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, also known as OCPD. And he has co-edited a comprehensive book on the subject. He is the lead author of the self-rated family accommodation scale for OCD, which is being used worldwide. And he serves on the International OCD Foundation Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board and is on the teaching faculty for the IOCDF's Behavioral Therapy Training Institute. So not only is he the voice on OCPD, but I also consider him a friend, and I'm so appreciative of his time and expertise. So without further ado, let's meet our panel on OCPD. Welcome back to the OCD Family Podcast, and I am so delighted today, y'all, because I know we have a fan favorite here, and Dr. Anthony Pinto coming to talk with us for this OCRD series about OCPD, and again, that is obsessive compulsive personality disorder. But today, Anthony brought friends, and so we also have Isabel and Mark, and this is a really busy time of year. But tell me, Isabel, what is your favorite thing about this time of year?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I think probably favorite time of this year is just getting to spend time with family, everyone being in this area, getting to touch base with everyone. It doesn't happen often, so it's nice to have that opportunity.
Love that. And Mark?
This time of year, I love baking pies and making soup. And as the colder weather sets in, it's perfect for both.
Oh, man, I love pie. I could go for some pie right now, but I'm not going to get distracted because we also want to say hello to Anthony. Anthony, welcome back to the podcast. And tell us, what's your favorite thing about this time of year?
Yeah. Thank you, Nicole. It's really great to be back. Love being on the show. Yeah, the holidays are a really special time in my house. We love like the family traditions, the decorating, the baking. I think the thing that sticks out the most is like turning on the fireplace and like having that like family time on the couch, watching a sappy movie or maybe, you know, doing some like reading together.
Yes. I love it. I love fireplaces as well. Well, welcome back and welcome to our newer guests. I'm so excited because we are talking about OCPD, and this has been a hot topic over the years that I've been running the podcast, and I think for an important reason. Some of the feedback we've heard is there's not enough information and there's not enough hope and understanding of what's going on for folks when we're talking about OCPD. And so, for starters, for anybody new joining us, Anthony, I wonder if you could give us an overview of understanding what is OCPD.
Yes, thank you, Nicole. And for your listeners, I would encourage them to go back to those last two episodes where we got into the clinical picture of OCPD, what brings people into treatment, and how to treat it. And today I'm excited to build on that by sharing some of Mark's lived experience, but also talking about some of the work we're doing at Northwell using group therapy for OCPD. So just want to start in terms of an overview to think about why we should all pay attention to OCPD, because as you said, it is unfortunately under-researched and under-recognized. So OCPD is one of the most prevalent of the personality disorders. And since I've been with you last, Nicole, there's been new data to show that the prevalence rate is about 6.5%. So that translates into about 1 in 15 adults. So this is something that is going to be showing up in the caseloads of any clinicians that are listening or amongst the listeners themselves or in their families. So it's prevalent. It impacts functioning and quality of life. It often shows up with other conditions, whether mood disorders or anxiety disorders, OCD, eating disorders, and it can interfere not only in people's lives, but also in treatment for other things that they're seeking treatment for. So the purpose of doing your podcast is really to continue to raise awareness, because unfortunately, this is a blind spot for a lot of clinicians, and also to raise more awareness among the public. So in terms of what OCPD is, I guess I'll just step back for a second and just reference personality in general. So personality is our own unique stamp on life, like what makes us uniquely ourselves. So whenever I come on here, I think it's really important to not only send the message of hope about treatment, but also to destigmatize. And so we're talking about a personality disorder and using a categorical label because we want to help people understand what that is. And it also helps with planning treatment, but we're not trying to stigmatize this condition. So when we talk about a personality disorder, we're talking about the three P's. We're talking about traits and behaviors that are persistent, meaning they've been in someone's life for a number of years. They are pervasive, they show up across contexts, and they're problematic in that they're affecting the person's functioning. And so what does it look like in OCPD? So the core features of OCPD are a maladaptive form of perfectionism that gets in the way of completing tasks, and rigidity that shows up in terms of insisting on one way of doing things or following certain rules and systems, which end up becoming very time consuming. Some of the other traits that we've talked about are a hyper-focus on details, rules, lists. These are people that may be excessively devoted to work at the expense of leisure or relationships. They tend to be hyper-moral or judgmental of other people, sometimes confrontational. They may have difficulty with accumulating clutter because of partially completed projects or reading material that they haven't gotten to. There's difficulty delegating tasks to other people, which can show up in problems in terms of sharing household chores or in terms of doing work or school projects. And they tend to be miserly in terms of spending on both themselves and other people. So a lot of these traits and behaviors have to do with over control, excessive time that's expended on doing even mundane tasks. And so there's a sense of burnout and frustration among these individuals. The other piece that I wanted to bring up, which you've discussed before, is that because you can arrive at this diagnosis in a variety of ways, it might be helpful to think about OCPD in terms of having certain style types. And so the two types that I tend to see most often are more of an anxious style and a controlling style. So the anxious style would be somebody who's going to be excessively indecisive, self-critical, more of a procrastinator, difficulty managing their time because they're so mired in details and slow in terms of how they process information because they're so focused on the detail local level. And they tend to over-explain things because of this focus on details. And the controlling style, on the other hand, are people that tend to resist change in routines and they're excessively rule-bound. They tend to be critical, judgmental of other people and have difficulty relating to sharing emotions. And these are the individuals that are more likely to have anger outbursts. What we see at Northwell in our center are more the anxious style. Those are the people that are more likely to show up for treatment. That's also the group where it's more likely to have a comorbid anxiety disorder or OCD. So happy to talk about any of that, but that's the nutshell overview of OCPD.
Excellent. And it's a drive-through overview, but we have so much to talk about. So again, Anthony mentioned our prior episodes. I'm going to also mention OCPD.org and Northwell's OCD Center. And all of that information is going to be linked over on this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. But I do have one quick question, Anthony.
Yeah.
With the new research, 1 in 15, I know prior there was about a 25% comorbidity rate with OCD. Are we seeing that number increase as well, or is that still roughly 1 in 4?
Yeah, that's been pretty stable. So if you look at individuals with OCD, the latest meta-analysis, there hasn't been another one, I think, since we last spoke, shows that if you characterize people with OCD, a quarter of them will meet full criteria of OCPD. But you will still see significant traits in a much larger group than that. And even having one or two of these traits at a clinical level can still interfere in someone's life. So I just want to make sure that clinicians are on the lookout for these traits, even in people who don't meet the full criteria for OCPD.
Yeah, and I want to say in our first episode, and again, that's going to be linked over on the blog, that's something we talk about because don't get swept into needing to meet full criteria. The point is, if it's getting in the way for you, if it's adding distress to your life, it's worth getting support to live your best life, to be able to live to your values. And that brings us to Mark, who is here to share with us about his lived experience of OCPD. And so I would love to the extent that you're comfortable, Mark, hear about what living with OCPD has meant for you and really when it became on the radar for you.
Yeah. About a year and a half ago, I first learned about OCPD. I wasn't aware of it prior to that point. Mm-hmm. My wife actually found the OCPD description online and shared it with me. And I read through it, and nearly every single thing on the list I could relate to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And I ended up listening to this podcast, your podcast, with Dr. Pinto, and the lived experience, I just thought that's how I was, and I didn't know that I really had much of a choice. I thought that that was my personality, let's say, and similar to what Dr. Pinto just described, perfectionism has been consistent in my life as long as I can remember, from my earliest childhood memories until now. Mm-hmm. Self-critical thought also relating to perfectionism most of the time, and a lot of rumination about both. The inability to relax or spend time focused on myself or leisure activities, like the inability to watch a movie or read a book or just do pretty much anything for myself consistently. Mm. And I'd hold myself to an impossibly high standard and take everything to, I felt, whether it was a personal thing, a work commitment, a family commitment, a volunteer commitment, everything was of equal importance and everything had to be done to 100% completion. And I didn't know there was another way, but I was burned out and I'm able to function on very little sleep. So I would complete everything. And the sacrifice was my health and sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, can I ask a quick question? Were you receiving praise for your execution of things, whether it was for work or it sounds like our spouses have that special ability to speak into us in those constructive ways, right? But a lot of people were probably providing you the feedback. Wow, Mark, right? This is really efficient. Wow, you got this done. It's not too much for Mark. Everybody look at him.
Yes, definitely. And I viewed many of the traits as beneficial, or so I thought, especially from a work perspective and being able to provide for myself and my family. But I noticed it getting in the way in a way that I and my wife recognized was not working, especially with regards to my family, my wife, my children, and also to a certain extent, extended family relationships.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Mark, what was it like when you read it? You said, oh my gosh, this is me, but also it can be hard when there's some kind of diagnosis attached to it or a personality disorder. That feels big. And so can I ask, what was it like, A, finding something that was so validating, but B, also going, what? Like, this is considered a disorder. What was that like for you?
Yeah, there's a little bit of discomfort around discovering that I more than likely had a personality disorder. Yet there's a lot of relief reading and listening, knowing that I wasn't alone. And Dr. Pinto mentioned even just a few moments ago and in the podcast I listened to a year and a half ago, the hope that it's a possibility to improve the quality of your life with treatment. And so I was eager to learn more. It had gotten to a point where I knew that something had to be done. So I was ready to try something. I just didn't know that OCPD was a thing.
Was a thing, right. And you know, you said it too. You said it earlier. You said, I didn't know I had a choice. And that sprung over in my head because I thought, yeah, it feels like before everything is to the utmost importance and you're getting the praise from it and you do have the value for it. So you want to do things well, but realizing you have a choice that can give you more bandwidth to do the things like read a book or binge watch a show or whatever the thing is. And so I love hearing your perspective on that. I really thank you for that. And we're going to get into what does treatment look like for this. But real quick first, maybe Isabel or Dr. Pinto, if you could help anybody listening, because perfectionism is one that gets tricky for people, especially delineating the difference between what is OCPD and what is OCD, and sometimes it can be both, but perfectionism can show up in big ways in both. And so can we clarify a differential between what is perfectionism, where it feels like more of a benefit, more value driven, versus perfectionism OCD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great question. So perfectionism has adaptive pieces to it, right? So striving to achieve certainly can be very adaptive and can lead to success, and it's a trait that we'll see in people who are high achievers. So when the perfectionism that we're talking about today that's associated with OCPD and can show up in other conditions like anorexia nervosa or OCD is a clinical perfectionism or a maladaptive perfectionism where the striving is for unrealistically attainable goals that the person then puts themselves through extreme self-sacrifice in order to achieve, which Mark was describing in terms of sacrifice of health with regard to diet or sleep, exercise, but also with regard to relationships and other quality of life and leisure. So it's a unrealistic setting of standards with self-sacrifice and self-criticism, which Mark also brought up. And so that kind of maladaptive perfectionism is associated with not only expressions of anxiety, but burnout and depression. And so that's something that clinicians particularly want to be on the lookout for. And I was really glad that you brought up, Nicole, how on the surface, these individuals may look like they're doing well, but as you do the assessment and you start to look at not just in the work domain or school, like how are they doing overall and what is their sense of quality of life and well-being? That's where you're going to notice the difficulty. And as Mark said, learning about this was so important because he was like, he thought like, this is who I am and this is how I go about life. But he was channeling so much energy into just achieving his goals and maintaining that he was really running out of fuel. So that is the perfectionism that we're talking about today. And like I said, it can show up in other conditions. Isabel, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I was just going to add quickly, I think, Nicole, you were also asking a bit about how do we differentiate perfectionism in OCD versus OCPD? And it's a tough question and definitely takes a lot of discussion about what it looks like, how it's showing up, how it's getting in the way, how long it's been an issue. The main way we differentiate the two is really whether it's ego dystonic or ego syntonic. And so essentially what I mean by that is that in OCPD, perfectionism is ego syntonic, meaning it's in line with how the person views the world. It's in line with their value system. There's a sense of this is how things should be. And oftentimes we see that the interference is coming from that burnout, from that stress, from their relationships. Whereas with OCD, it's more ego dystonic, meaning it's not necessarily in line with who they are as a person, how they view the world. They might even very much view the perfectionism as being excessive or not in line with what they actually want. And there's a level of it being kind of discordant with who they are, what they want, how they see the world.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful clarification. And again, both can exist, right? It's not always one or the other. But I think actually even culturally, when we think about perfectionism, we think of it more in this value-driven, beneficial way of I'm trying to refine my skill, create the perfect solution here, where within OCD, we're going to find it more like, ugh, if I don't, these bad things might happen. There's going to be some kind of intrusive or unwanted consequence to that. And in the context we're talking about, there would be distress if it wasn't executed to the level that was desired. But it's different, like you said, Isabel. It's the difference of being ego dystonic versus ego syntonic.
Yeah, since there may be new listeners, another differentiation between OCD and OCPD is that in OCD, you will have the presence of obsessions. Obsessions are unwanted or intrusive thoughts that create a lot of fear, a need for certainty or safety. They tend to have a more rational quality to them, as opposed to, as Isabel said, in OCPD, you'll still see methodical, ritualized behaviors, but there is not going to be that fixation on these like feared outcomes.
And Anthony, it is interesting, right? Because I was like, yeah, that is a key part of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. But I think what throws people off sometimes about OCPD is it's obsessive compulsive personality disorder, but obsessive somewhat operationalized in a different way. It's more of like the amount of fuel and energy needed to be put towards something versus having these intrusive thoughts that struggle with uncertainty, et cetera.
Yeah, it's really an unfortunate name for OCPD because the diagnostic definition of obsession is like more this intrusive quality.
Yeah.
The obsessive in OCPD is more of like a hyper-focus and a tense deliberateness that is more about like a fixation on details and time and money. But yeah, one of the questions I often get is, why are these names overlapping? OCPD really should be named something else, like more of a rigid perfectionism or something else that gets at this control aspect, because the overlap in names creates a lot of confusion among the public and clinicians.
Yeah. And you know, Anthony, I'll bring up here too, in terms of things that get confused or can look very similarly, but there are some very functional differences. I'm thinking about for our autistic friends in the community, a lot of times this question will come up. I know even at this year's conference, people were like, but how do you differentiate this from autism? And so I know we've covered this in past episodes, but because I think, again, similar to OCD and OCPD sounding very similar, some people will hear hyperfixation or rigidity around certain ways things need to be done. And there may be some of that exemplified for our neurodivergent friends. And so I'm wondering if you could speak to that for just a moment. We won't get too off topic here, but would love a differentiation.
Yes, I think the autism OCPD differentiation is something that a clinician would have to like carefully assess and to differentiate. And some of the key differences are going to be in terms of the developmental history. So you really want to like go back and ask, you know, the individual that you're assessing about developmental milestones. In somebody with a more traditional presentation of OCPD, you're not going to see those developmental delays. There's also more of a focus on sensory issues in people with autism. So that might be driving some of the methodical behaviors you see in autism and some of the more rigid patterns. It's going to be like very sensory driven. And there's also going to be a difference in terms of interpersonal functioning. And while people with OCPD may have difficulties relating to or sharing of emotions, you're going to see more profound challenges in that kind of interpersonal functioning with autism. But as you said, you can see these things co-occur, so it does get complicated. But those are some of the main ways that they can be differentiated.
I was talking recently with Dr. Stacey Grader, who is a psychiatrist down in the Florida area. She is also an autistic ADHDer. And she was talking about, let's not conflate a neurological processing for autistic folks, how we're processing the world, versus a personality trait, which though is brain-based, personality isn't the same as saying, okay, I am autistic and everything is being processed through this neurochemistry. But yeah, I think those are great points. So with that, we're talking about an overview of treatment, and I appreciate all the clarifications and the help there. And so how do we treat OCPD?
Yeah, great question. And this is going to be, you know, an important piece of what we're going to talk about today. So first of all, I want to just continue to say that there is, unfortunately, even though this has been known about since the earliest descriptions or in the early 1900s by Freud and his contemporaries, in all of this time, there still, which is quite astounding, there still has not been a true randomized controlled trial of psychotherapy in OCPD, despite how prevalent this is and how long we've known about it. So we don't have the definitive studies to point to an empirically evidence-based treatment for OCPD. However, there has been some work in this area, and we have suggestions of things that might work. So there are some things that are in development, like metacognitive interpersonal therapy, radically open DBT. What I do and what Isabel does at the center is we operate within the frame of cognitive behavioral therapy. And the most robust data that we have in terms of psychotherapy treatment for OCPD is in the area of clinical perfectionism. And the vast majority of studies in that area have been using CBT, as well as a newer generation of CBT called acceptance and commitment therapy. So that's how we operate at Northwell, and that's the treatment that Mark is going to talk more about. So CBT is going to be looking at the connection between one's feelings, emotions, physiological sensations, as well as their thoughts and the behaviors in the triangle of those three pieces and how they all interrelate. And so CBT is going to help one allow and come to more acceptance about their feelings, emotionals, and physiological state, to be able to better observe their thoughts and to better evaluate them, as well as changing behaviors ultimately in terms of having better treatment outcomes, creating more time and space for their values. So we're going to break down some of the components of CBT today. The other intervention for OCPD would be in the area of medication. And this is another area where there has been strikingly little work done in terms of research, but the data that we do have give some support for selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors to treat the anxiety and depressive symptoms that come along with OCPD. So there are some medication options to treat some of the things that come alongside OCPD traits. So that's the overview, but we're going to get into the breakdown of it.
I love that. Thank you for the overview. So when we talk about this within the context, first of individual therapy,
Mark,
again, to the extent that you would be comfortable sharing, we'd love to hear about what your experience was like doing individual therapy for OCPD.
Yeah, with individual therapy, much like what Dr. Pinto just described, we started off with breath work. Mm-hmm. We started off with a lot of self-monitoring, like note-taking throughout the week to, as I look back on it, to slow down and be able to analyze and have a different perspective on my thought process and to look back through it in the individual therapy with that guidance, and rather than see it as only the one way I knew, be able to see other options and other choices and see where I might be stuck or just not even considering that there was a choice being made, and labeling emotions and reactions and just taking a pause, essentially. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I remember from the earliest experiences with the individual therapy was this discussion of values. And like Dr. Pinto and Isabel described, I can relate to, there's the like hyper moral, and I had very high standards, like my values are part of who I am, yet I didn't ever put it on paper and break it down in a way to analyze how I was spending my time and how that aligned with my values, and that I had a choice in how I was spending my time in alignment or not with my values.
Yeah. And you know what? What I really love and appreciate about what you're sharing is that it's not about saying you shouldn't value that. It's about understanding the cost and how much energy you're putting towards, or fuel you're putting towards it. And if you're putting so much fuel towards everything, it's not sustainable, right? You are going to burn out, like you were talking about earlier. And so treatment actually allows you to connect and find a way, a path forward to be able to live to your values. Because when you're so exhausted and burn out, it's impossible. And we were talking even before we started recording about parenting. And so you add on something like parenting that's already exhausting. Love the kids, but they're exhausting. And there's so many important values that I'm not actually finding joy and even allowing myself space to recharge with a good book or anything like that, because I am so burned out. And so I love that treatment was in part learning how you can connect more, because the idea probably prior to treatment was I'm trying to live to all my values. And you realize like, gosh, I'm missing out on most of this because I'm running on fumes.
Exactly. Yeah. And when I first read about OCPD prior to treatment, prior to working with anybody at the OCD center, I had this worry in the back of my mind. And I expressed this as well in my intake interview and when I first started individual therapy, that I was nervous to, I wanted to change. I was curious and excited to learn about the opportunities to live a more balanced life, to enjoy life more. At the same time, I was worried how that would impact my work. I thought, oh, if these things that I view as such an important aspect of my success at work change, what impact is that going to have? And I remember everyone I worked with at the OCD Center highlighted that the therapy wasn't prescriptive in a way that all that therapy was the same for everybody, that we each as individuals got the opportunity to define whatever our values are, and we are helped along the way to live a more fulfilled life, whatever that looks like for each individual. And once I understood that, I think any of those fears and barriers I had up kind of disappeared.
I love that. And I so appreciate you speaking to that, because I think so many people, I would imagine, at least with lived experience, are going, well, am I going in the treatment center, or the therapist, et cetera, the family around me that's been maybe giving me this feedback? Do they have an agenda to change what's important to me and say, you shouldn't care so much? And it's not that you shouldn't care so much. No, it's actually you care a lot. And so let's help you feel connected and more balance in the things you care about. And yes, that might mean some changes of choices and how we really budget our energy. But at the same time, now you get more fulfilling satisfaction out of being able to connect to the things that you value. It's not about
my wife says I need to stop doing this, and now I'm going to go and I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. It shouldn't be, at least. I mean, it shouldn't be an agenda outside of you being able to live your value-driven life. And so I really appreciate you sharing about that. And so what we're going to talk about next is then you guys over at Northwell have a unique program because you're one of the few that specialize in OCPD. But we're going to also talk about some of the differences or overlaps even between individual and group therapy. And so, Isabel, I want to bring it to you. We heard a little bit of Mark's experience in individual, but also how is the program and the treatment formatted and what is recommended, individual or group or both? Would love to hear more.
Yeah, great question. So a lot of our individuals who come to us with OCPD are in both individual and group. And we really think of group as something to complement individual therapy. And I'm sure Mark and Dr. Pinto can talk a little bit more about that as well. But there are benefits of group therapy that people don't necessarily get in individual, or they get less of in individual. The greatest benefit of group therapy is just this opportunity for support from peers, from people who have similar lived experiences.
Yeah.
And that ability to feel less alone, to hear about people who have had similar challenges. And I think with that oftentimes comes a decrease in some of the stigma that is really oftentimes associated with OCPD and with personality disorders in general. I think some other benefits are there are so many opportunities then for feedback from peers, both in terms of accountability. So oftentimes in our groups, we have members set homework assignments or behavioral commitments, and then they have a full host of people holding them accountable in a very, I think, supportive, compassionate way, wanting to see them do whatever is going to be best in terms of their long-term progress, and really just have this like check-in system plan. So our groups typically meet weekly, and so someone can set a goal and then a week later check in with all of the other group members about how that goal went. There's also a modeling component that I think is very beneficial. We see group members talk a lot in our groups about how to apply these specific skills to their unique challenges. And with that, people get to watch each other apply the skills, and that helps them to then apply the skills themselves.
Yeah.
And also just increase motivation. So if one group member sees another group member using a skill successfully and sees that that is really working for them and actually causing an increase in their ability to experience joy, to live according to their values, I think that helps with some of the motivation. And then I would say lastly, so everyone in our group is also an individual at some point. So a requirement for our group is that people have been an individual. Though we oftentimes see that group members, once they end their individual therapy at the center, will continue in our groups. And so we've also seen that the groups help serve kind of like a maintenance or relapse prevention function, where group members kind of keep themselves sharp on the skills, can continue applying the skills, can hold themselves accountable even after that individual therapy had ended.
I love that. And one of the things that you highlighted there first, and I love the emphasis of where it fell first, whether it was intentional or not, was really normalizing, letting people know they're not alone. Anthony at the top of the show said, 1 in 15 people, this is so normal. And so many people are living with this sense of shame, this sense of exhaustion, this sense of distress and loneliness, maybe because it's harder to engage in their value-driven relationships because they're so busy. There's not enough time in the day. And it is such an important piece for people to know that they're not alone. So I love that emphasis. And I wonder for you, Mark, you talked a little bit about what it was like being an individual. What did you find that the group added that you weren't getting in individual therapy? What was one of the differences that stood out for you?
Primarily that I wasn't alone. That we, like Isabel mentioned, I think the group I'm currently in, there's roughly 10 of us. And it has been equally important to the individual therapy. As I was looking back on the progress I've made, there are certain things I tie to individual therapy and there are certain things I tie to the group therapy. And I really think that both have been integral in my journey. The group has helped me identify blind spots. certain things that I wasn't even aware of, that someone else's lived experience and their generosity in sharing has highlighted things for me, whether it's exactly the same or similar. When I first started out in the group, I had never been in group therapy before. I was a little curious and nervous, and I was relieved once I joined the group. The dynamic of our group has people on many phases of their journey, many places. Like, some people have been in individual therapy in the group for, at least when I joined, for about a year, if I remember correctly. And others had been there for a couple months, others a couple weeks. And that really helped me feel comfortable. And there's so many things from the various individuals in our group that I have jotted down brief notes about things that have been said that I can relate to and going throughout my daily life. There's specific things I think about almost on a daily basis that I can tie to things I've learned from group therapy. And yeah.
I love that. And, you know, I think that is part of the power of group therapy. There's no wrong place to start. And sometimes it depends on the structure of the program. If you're coming into treatment together and there might be a lot of new people in treatment, but I think there's so much value. Just like even if we're thinking about just general life experience, if we're with a group of people that we have some folks that are older than us, some that are younger than us, they have different experiences. We can share about it. We can give wisdom. We can receive wisdom. It's similar in the group structure that you can have people that are like, okay, we've been at this, but they also might have some blind spots that they've been at it so long they didn't see. And somebody with some new fresh eyes coming in can go, how's this functioning? How's this working? And vice versa. And so I love that. I think that's a beautiful thing. And when we talk about groups, I think sometimes a common question that comes up is, are we talking about, okay, we heard Mark said group therapy, we're talking about group therapy. What's the difference between group therapy or, say, a support group? And how do we understand the benefit, or if I should be seeking out a group, like what kind of group should I be seeking out? And so would love maybe, Isabel, if you want to start us off with some differences there.
Yeah, great question. I think oftentimes when people hear group, they think about support groups because of all we see kind of represented in the media. So oftentimes people think of things like AA or Alcoholics Anonymous, which is more of a support group than a treatment group, with the main differentiation being that support groups are peer-led. So oftentimes there's not a therapist or licensed clinician present. It really serves more of that support function we were talking about, getting feedback from peers. There might not be a direct focus on intervention. And like I said, the biggest difference is that it's really focused on that peer relationship, peer interaction.
Yeah.
Oftentimes with that, we also see that support groups are open to anyone. So anyone can join regardless of maybe even the physical location or state that they're in, regardless if they've met with a therapist beforehand. Really, they're more open to whoever is interested.
Yeah. That's a great point. And Anthony, maybe you could help shed some light on then treatment groups. So we understand from Isabel's excellent sharing thus far that it's support-led versus clinician-led, but would love to understand from your perspective more about treatment groups.
Yeah. And we can mention this again later, but you brought up OCPD.org. There is a support group that people can read more about if they go to OCPD.org. The name of the group is You, Me, and OCPD. It's free. It runs twice a month, and it is open to both those with OCPD and family members. So that's a resource that's available to anyone, no matter where you live. So the differentiation between a support group, again, peer-led, versus a treatment group like what we offer at the Northwell Health OCD Center is a treatment group is led by a licensed clinician. It is going to be in the frame of a treatment modality. So our treatment groups are based on these core principles and skills of CBT and ACT, and we include emotion regulation pieces in it as well. So it's the content is very similar to what we would do if someone has a course of individual therapy, but here we are teaching a skill and then adapting it to the individual lives of the people in the group, and then leveraging their lived experience as a way to look at what was it like when you applied this skill, what were some of the challenges you faced, and then everyone in the group can benefit from hearing about the experiences of using that skill by that individual. So it is focused on evidence-based approaches. The group we run is one where people can join at any point, really. So it's not a closed group in that we gather a group of individuals and then just have that cohort for a period of time. This is like more of an open enrollment process. But there is a very careful like vetting or screening process for individuals to come into the group, because I run both of the groups that we have at Northwell, and Isabel co-leads with me because we have a training program at Northwell. So we have individuals who are working on their doctorates in psychology like Isabel. And so it's a great training experience. So the individuals are assessed prior to coming in to see if they would be a good fit for the group, meaning that OCPD is the primary thing that they're looking to work on, and that they are somebody that we believe would be a good group member, and that they would be open to that modality, and that they would be willing to share, but also to receive the input from other people in the group. I have to say that I've been running these OCPD groups for the last 12 years at Northwell, and it is, of the many hats I wear as director of this program, it's one of my favorite things to do. And for a lot of the things that Mark was sharing about before, but it's a really, it's the normalizing, the destigmatizing, it's the motivation aspect, but it's also about an opportunity to honor people's personality strengths, and while specifically targeting these maladaptive strategies that are getting in their way. And I had one of my original group members say to me that OCPD group is the mirror that talks back to me, which I think is a really nice poetic way of describing how group therapy can be really helpful.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, just for any person, having a group of people that care about you and want to honor your personality strengths, how often are people sitting around honoring people's personality strengths? I feel like we could use more of that across the general population. And so it's a beautiful way of framing it, because I think so often the stigma around any mental health disorder, but particularly when we're thinking of personality disorders, they're misunderstood. There's a lot of ignorance, and then people make snap judgments. And really, this is a process of honoring personality strengths individually so that you can feel like you have more work-life balance, but also that group aspect. I love how that creates some balance and that constructive mirror from people that are walking those similar roads. We're all uniquely individual, so we all have our own roads, but we can speak to the journey, we can speak to the struggles, and how beautiful to have that type of support. So can I ask, does this group, some people may be in it a year, some people less, is this open-ended in terms of how long you would be in the group and participate? Because it sounds like Isabel said earlier, some people do individual and choose to stay in the group. What are the parameters with that?
Yeah, we at the OCD Center have a variety of groups, because we also treat OCD as well as people who have both OCD and OCPD. And for our exposure groups, we tend to have more of like a 1 year time frame. But then we have maintenance groups for people who have completed their OCD treatment, and those tend to be open ended. For the OCPD groups, it tends to be more this open ended style, meaning that they have already, in some cases, they've completed a course of individual OCPD treatment, and then they stay on in the OCPD group for as long as we mutually agree that it's beneficial to them. And we have people who then say, I feel like I have the skills now, I can be my own therapist, and they'll go off and graduate from group. But it's really like a discussion about when we think would be the right time. But there's no set time limit for the group. I could tell you a little bit more about the nuts and bolts of the Northwell groups. We usually cap at about 10 members. They are led by a licensed psychologist as well as a psychology trainee. They meet weekly for 1 hour, and it's done on Zoom. These groups were in person prior to COVID, but now we have found, since we've made that transition to virtual groups, it really helps those that are at a distance to attend. So the individuals who participate in our OCPD groups have to be in New York State, because that's where I'm licensed. So treatment groups are going to be geographically limited to the license of the person running it. Members can join on a rolling basis, as we mentioned, and we do attend to privacy requirements, meaning that the individuals who attend the group have to every week make assurance that they are in a private space and that we don't have any expectation that anyone else will be coming into that space, because we really want to protect the privacy of all the members and make it a safe space. You also need to be in a stationary place. You can't be in a moving vehicle or obviously not driving, you know, for safety reasons. So you know, those are the parameters for the group.
Excellent. And so I know for so many folks listening all over the world, not just here in the U.S., but all over the world, they're going, oh, it's in New York. And how do we do this? How do we create this? And tell me more about the nuts and bolts of how treatment looks. And so we're going to talk about the main skills in the CBT group for OCPD. And Isabel, if you would start us off with education about OCPD. And again, I know we covered at the top of the show and in past podcasts, we're not going to go super in depth here. But to what degree do you go into the education piece? Because as you said before, everyone has done some individual work at this point. So I imagine that's covered pretty thoroughly in the psychoeducation there as well. But how is education or psychoeducation covered in a group?
Yeah. So we definitely do spend a decent amount of time covering psychoeducation at the beginning of treatment, even for those who have already gotten that from individual therapy. Part of that's because it's always helpful to review. And then part of it is because we have members in our groups with both OCPD and OCD. And so some of our group members, individual treatment is more focused on OCD and they've done less OCPD work. So it's helpful to start everyone from this mutual understanding of what OCPD is, what it looks like, how it gets in the way. And we also really use the time for community building and support. Mm. So people can start talking about like what OCPD uniquely looks like for them, how it affects them, how it's impacted their lives, and what they want to get out of group, what they're hoping will change. Because I think something we've really been careful to emphasize here is that the goal of treatment is never to change the fundamental core aspects of a person's personality or who they are, but rather to focus on where are these traits starting to get in the way or to become excessive, and can we start modulating some of that? Can we start helping them to reduce the amount that these traits are getting in the way?
Yeah.
So focusing on like, what are the unique group members' goals? What goals do they share? How can we as group leaders and the other group members support these goals? And also talking a little bit about how OCPD differs from OCD, since you have members in our group who have both experiences.
Yeah.
So I think this psychoeducation piece is really helpful just from a normalization standpoint, a goal setting standpoint. And we definitely do spend the early portions of group really focusing on it.
Can I ask, does it get tricky when you have, I already know. Does it get tricky? Come on. Anything I say next is going to be like, yes, but does it get tricky when you have some folks that are also going through the thick of it with their OCD to keep on task for OCPD? Since OCD is not going to be relevant for everyone in the group, because I can imagine, I know I have lived experience of OCD myself, how immersive it can be. And so depending where people are at in their treatment, I would imagine that can get a little sticky.
Yeah. I'm sure Dr. Pinto could speak to this perhaps more than I can, but I think we also, in assessing for fit for the group, really pay attention to that. I think there have been times where we've had group members who do a trial run on group and are very focused on OCD and aren't able to meaningfully engage in discussions about OCPD. And at that point, we might decide that that person isn't the best fit for the group at this very time. Maybe later on, when their OCD is better managed, they could join this group. But it does become a tricky question, because then we also know that OCPD can get in the way of ERP treatment for OCD. So it's like a whole, which came first, the chicken or the egg type of situation.
Right.
So it is, to answer your question, yes, it's tricky is the most straightforward answer.
Yeah.
We do find that if people are getting derailed or stuck in their ERP for OCD and they have OCPD, it may be helpful to really focus in on flexibility and bolster that piece of things. So something like individual therapy for OCPD or the add-on of group therapy can be helpful for those individuals to really focus in on the flexibility or the perfectionism that might be getting in the way of their OCD treatment. But we really try to frame these meetings, our OCPD group meetings, to be about OCPD. We name it. We're very transparent about it. We do a lot of education about it. And for those where OCD is really like bubbling up as like so interfering that they can't access or do the things that we're working on in this OCPD group, it may be time to just to pause and to really lean into more individual work or some of our other groups so that they can then return to the OCPD group when they're better able to focus on this aspect.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And something I'm trying to recall which episode it was from, but I think something we've talked about in the past, Anthony, too, is OCPD is very, very distressing, especially when you get to a D level of anything. The disorder level means it's starting to interfere in different areas of functioning. And so for a lot of people coming in, a lot of our fam here, you're going to be more familiar with OCD. And we know how distressing OCD is. But what I think is really important and hopefully something that we've been able to highlight, not just in this episode, but in prior episodes. And if there's one thing I wish, and to be transparent with a goal I have for even our chat together today, is for people to understand when we're talking about OCPD, it can be incredibly, incredibly distressing. Mm-hmm. And so overwhelming and so limiting in terms of your ability to really engage in life. Like Mark was talking about earlier, you've been having free time. What's that? Time. What's that? And so I think a lot of people are aware of how distressing OCD is, which speaks to the work we've done in educating here, because a lot of people didn't understand it before. Media doesn't portray it well, but OCPD also is completely misunderstood in this. And so it is really, really important for people to have that space to be able to recognize that they're not broken people. They're just having a struggle with some choices that they didn't know were choices. And there is hope and there is support and there are 1 in 15. Look around. You're not alone in this. So I love that point. And that kind of speaks to the readiness and vulnerability factors. If there's anything else, Isabel, you would add in there, please feel free.
Yeah. So I think we talked a lot about how the distress of OCPD often comes in the form of this like burnout.
Yeah.
This stress-related exhaustion, this feeling like a person is completely on empty. They have no mental resources left. And with that, it can be hard for people with OCPD to meaningfully engage in treatment because they're already doing so much. There's so little mental energy to put towards treatment. And so early on in our groups, we really like to focus on allocating more resources to treatment and to really replenishing a person's mental resources mm-hmm. so they can put more towards therapy. And oftentimes what that looks like is we use this metaphor of a gas tank where we say, you know, if your gas tank is on empty, you're not going to have anything to put towards treatment. And so we start talking about what are things we can do to start refilling your gas tank, even really small things, which don't necessarily feel small, like allocating 30 minutes for exercise or making sure you're eating 3 meals a day or trying to have a consistent sleep schedule. All of these things are going to help replenish that gas tank and give a person just more reserves, both mental, physical, whatever it's going to be, to first participate in the group, but then also to take what they do in the group and apply it elsewhere in their lives.
Yeah, I love that. And a word that popped up for me, and I don't know, because I would imagine this can get tricky, but I think of the word self-care, like just taking even some time, a moment for yourself, get a drink of water, get some sunshine, get some vitamin D, whatever the thing is. Take an actual lunch break. Don't work through your lunch break. Self-care is so helpful in refueling that tank. But sometimes it can be also viewed as this is a selfish thing. I've got so much to do. There's not enough time in the day. And we know if our batteries are empty or our fuel tanks. I love the imagery of that because I think in analogies all the time, and I think that's helpful. We have to be able to add fuel, sometimes just even eating, actually getting some protein, fuel for the body to be able to continue forward. So I think that's a really good point.
Yeah, exactly. The therapy itself, whether it's individual or group, is going to be effortful and it's going to require gas in the tank. And so if that tank is flashing on empty, we really need to address that first before we do the behavior change that's going to be part of this treatment. So even taking small steps towards replenishing, because these individuals tend to be intense and they tend to be rigid about how they go about self-care. So we really want to dial down the amount of intensity there, but have some way of approaching the replenishing of the guest tank so that they can be fully present and in the best shape possible to do the behavior change of the therapy.
Yeah, really great point. And so I know something that we've talked about before, Anthony, is this concept of the dimmer switch. And again, in terms of how we're budgeting energy or how we're allocating our fuel, I have always really loved this analogy, but I would love for maybe any new family or just as a review, like Isabel said, never hurts to revisit psychoeducation. Can you share more about what that looks like and how you use this dimmer switch mentality for treatment?
Yeah, this is one of my favorite metaphors because I think it's, you know, the visual can be really helpful for people. So if you think about a light switch, it's either on or off. I mean, that tends to be the way that a lot of people with OCPD approach the effort that they put into a task or the amount of time that they put into a decision. So it's that all or nothing. I'm either going to put maximum effort or not at all. The problem with the light switch is that it doesn't allow for any modulation or gradations of effort for things that don't really require 100% effort. So what we're trying to get people to understand, whether it's an individual or in group, is let's imagine that you could dial up or down the amount of effort you put into a task, a la a dimmer switch, based on how important that particular task or decision is to you in your life and how connected it is to your values. And so Mark talked before about taking that pause, and that pause is going to be really important as a way to use this dimmer switch, because if you don't take the pause before you enter into a task or a decision, you will go towards your default mode, which is maximizing. And so taking that pause and grounding yourself would allow you to say, okay, I'm going to be loading the dishwasher. This doesn't need to be my shining moment of the day. I can dial down my effort and put in deliberately little effort for something that's really not so important in the big scheme of my values. This is something to get done, but it doesn't have to be done with great finesse and with great precision. So it's really a tool for determining how much effort I will put into this task. And how much energy does this actually require? Because one of the things we keep hitting on today is that OCPD, there's a time allocation problem. And so if we want to allocate more time towards bigger values, we need to conserve time on things that are of low importance. And so the dimmer switch allows you to turn down, even though it's going to be uncomfortable because I'm used to being very precise about my chores, I'm going to turn down my effort because I want to save time for my relationships and for my other aspects of quality of life.
Yeah, I love that. And I love, again, how it honors the individual, because it's not to say loading the dishwasher can't be important. Imagine you're hosting a dinner party and you're like, I need things to run efficiently, and this is really high on my list. Okay, so we're going to allocate the energy there to make it as efficient and as helpful to do the event that we want to be able to put on. But most days, I'm guessing we're not putting on dinner parties. We're not having VIP people over and all of that. And it's not to say that there's one right or wrong reason on why this can be a value. But in the scheme of all the things you need to get done in a day, I almost think of like a pie chart where it's like, okay, well, I need to get that done, but there's 50 other things I need to get done and there's just no time. Plus, I'm supposed to at some point hang out with family, maybe read a book, I don't know, listen to a podcast. But yeah, I love how it honors the individual. And so I wonder, Mark, again, to the extent that you would be comfortable sharing, how have you applied this dimmer switch analogy in your experience of treatment?
I've been able to apply the dimmer switch in so many different aspects of my life. Like Dr. Pinto mentioned, I was living in a kind of all or nothing, generally all lifestyle. And taking that pause, reflecting on how it aligns with how I want to spend my hour or day or week, and how that aligns with my values, work being important, also my family and spending time with them is equally, if not more important, based on my values I've chosen. The ability to turn down the energy and time that I put into any given task, like putting dishes in the dishwasher, vacuuming the house, leaving unfolded laundry for a day or two because there's something else that is more important to my values. And the dimmer switch has helped me in my flexibility, yeah, be less rigid. And also it's the constant chatter for me of the perfectionistic tendencies or thoughts. It's allowed me to kind of turn those internal voices down, like pause, acknowledge those are thoughts I'm having and maybe thoughts I will continue having, but turn them down so that I can put my energy into something that I'm choosing rather than my default.
Yeah.
So the dimmer switch has been, it was a novel concept. I remember when I first heard about it, I was like, wow, I didn't know that I could do anything less than 100%. So
yeah.
Yeah.
It's a choice piece. Like I can choose how I turn it up and down.
Right. And it doesn't mean that you don't care about the things. And I think too, like you were saying in the beginning, Mark, if I was understanding you correctly, you didn't want to have to change the quality of the work that you do or not care about it anymore. And it's not even about not caring. It can be confusing and maybe tricky for people to understand. But if you realize like, okay, I only have this much energy, I only have this much to work with, and I still care, I still want things done well, but I just can't take the amount of time here if I also want to be dad over here and make it to the soccer game and do something for myself because I need to be able to recharge so I can go to work tomorrow or whatever the thing is. And so in OCD, we'll say thoughts are just thoughts. But I like what you were saying. In OCPD, we can say, well, thoughts can be turned down and thoughts can be turned up. So it's not that the thoughts don't matter and they are just thoughts. We don't have to respond to it just because we thought that could be done better. But we also can choose to turn it down and say, yes, it's still important, but not as important in the grand scheme of things that I need to get done today. And so I'm going to allow this load of laundry that's clean not to be folded yet. Or I'm going to allow myself 5 minutes and however far I get on the dishes and then I'm moving on to the next task because I'm allowing myself that amount of time. And I think that's wonderful. And I would imagine for you, because this is OCD family podcast, so we always think of things in family terms. I imagine for your family, too, they noticed a difference with that, huh, Mark?
Definitely. Yeah. In so many different ways. They've noticed a difference. I've noticed a difference. The relationship I have with my wife and my children has dramatically improved, aligned with my values,
yeah,
with the course of treatment.
Yeah.
When I'm at that soccer game, I'm able to turn down the need to be available for work or to respond to work emails and focus on the soccer game or whatever it is I'm involved with.
Yeah, I heard a funny parenting meme about soccer games or, you know, little league games to the extent of you get to go and for 3 hours watch like one person score a goal or something to that extent. But it is the joy and the value, again, that you get out of being able to be present. And so many times if we're so busy working on so many things, it takes away from our ability to be present. You know, Anthony, I was thinking about in recent years, there's been a campaign around learning more about growth mindset. And that reminds me very much of this conversation. And again, I wouldn't be surprised, 1 in 15 people. But so much of having a growth mindset is learning to have some of that flexibility and allowing some room for us to be able to connect with our values and say less to this thing to get more of this over here.
Yeah, growth mindset is a part of this, definitely, because it's about failing forward, making mistakes, allowing yourself to take some chances because it's associated with the life you want. And so I think that plays really well into some of these other aspects of behavior change, like willingness that we're going to cover, as well as behavioral experiments.
Yeah, absolutely. So Isabel, in terms of when we think about the values, we've talked about an ACT acceptance and commitment therapy is very big in this value language as well. But in terms of helping group members connect to their values, especially since it is going to be unique to each individual, can you talk more about how, because a lot of people probably coming into the group even, or at the beginning, maybe not just coming in, but
depending on where they are in their journey, their value is going to be, I want to do all of this well, though. I really need and want to do this well. Like Mark was saying, I want to do the all. Was the all in the all or nothing? So can you talk to us a little more about values?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure people have heard that values is a really critical part of treating OCPD. I would probably argue that it's the most important part. And this is because people with OCPD, especially people who are coming to treatment, are oftentimes noticing a misalignment between how they're spending their time and their values. And oftentimes, yes, it is a value to get the work done well, but that's only one value. And so we're noticing an imbalance of these values. So they might be spending all of their time on one particular value, such as work or productivity, at the expense of other things that are equally, if not more important to them, like family, their relationships, leisure, self-care. And I love that you brought up this imagery of a pie chart, because that's actually, I saw Mark smiling, and it's actually something that we use a lot in our groups and individual as well, where we have our group members actually identify their values and then create pie charts based on how they're currently spending their time. And at the beginning of treatment, we noticed that many of our group members are spending the vast majority of their time dedicated to work. So their pie charts might be like 80, 90% work with very, very little room left over for the other pieces. And we talk about how, like, yes, it would be amazing if we could give all of our group members just more hours of the day. We can't do that. And something's got to give in that pie chart then. We can't add more slices to the pie chart. We got to take away. We got to reallocate. And so we ask our group members to identify what values are being underrepresented in their daily lives and to then set specific behavioral commitments to increasing those values. So for example, if a person identifies, hey, I'm spending way too much time at work, like 90% of my pie chart is work, and I'm really feeling actually that I'm missing out on my relationship with my partner, we might set a specific goal of like, okay, one day this week, I want to leave work early or leave work at an appropriate time to go on a date night. So really focusing on turning it then into concrete assignments and steps to make this a little bit more manageable.
Yeah, great points. And again, this actually goes into our next point really well, because it can be hard, especially in the process of learning to allocate different slices of the pie or budget time and energy here, to allow ourselves that room and give ourselves compassion and grace for feeling like we left something undone, not quite to the quality that we know is possible, that we're capable of. And I think capability gets thrown around in a lot of different areas of life. Because if you're capable, then you should be able to do it, right? Well, it's not that simple, because a lot of times there's lots of things we're capable of doing, but is that what we need to do? And to your point, even Isabel, what you were saying, is that prioritizing one value and missing a lot of other values in the midst of that? And so can you speak to that inner voice, Anthony, that is going to be wanting to sharpen and improve things? And so a byproduct of that, I would imagine, is that self-criticism that can come out and just the process of how that is handled in group.
Yeah. So first of all, just giving people some education that that inner critic, the self-criticism, is a big part of the OCPD experience. And so we start by first acknowledging that, because that is a commonality that the members can immediately relate to. And so a part of what we do in group is to teach people to be more aware of the role of self-critical thinking, because many of us have grown up with this notion that if I want to push myself to achievement, I have to be hard driving. I have to be really on myself and demanding of myself. And so we outline a metaphor of teacher one and teacher two, teacher one being that very demanding, critical presence versus teacher two, who is still holding the student accountable, but does it in a more compassionate way. And when we present those two scenarios and say, what kind of teacher would you want for your child? The group members invariably say, oh, I would like my child to have teacher two. But then we ask, what kind of teacher are you to yourself? And then they usually acknowledge that it's teacher one. So that awareness can be really helpful. And then we use other strategies to make people aware of how that inner critic might be impacting behavior. And so we'll use another metaphor called the passengers on the bus, where we have them, and we do this through a meditation, have the individual imagine driving a bus down the road towards the life you value, as Isabel described. But as you're driving, you have these passengers that are coming up and yelling all kinds of derogatory things to you, telling you that you're going to fail, that you're never going to amount to anything. And members then are asked, how do you usually react when those critical passengers are yelling at you? Do you pull over, in which you then become stagnant and you're not moving towards your values? Do you start fighting with those passengers, which also derails the bus? Do you freeze? So we go through these different scenarios. And so the point of that is to help people to understand or better manage the relationship they have with thoughts and to allow them to see that just because this noise, I have this noisy brain or this noise is around me, this critical noise, doesn't mean I have to actually do anything about it. And so we're allowing them, giving permission to just allow the noise while you continue moving towards a value direction. And we also help them to try to see, could these passengers want what's best for you, but are going about it in a really harmful way? And so try to get them to better understand what could be behind the inner critic voices. And eventually, we also talk about how to show care to yourself, because these individuals in group are usually really good at being supportive of other people, but not so much of themselves. So try to get them to shift towards, what would you say to a friend in this situation? How can you adopt what you would say to a friend to yourself and help them to schedule time to be with themselves, to reframe these self-critical thoughts into more self-compassionate statements? So self-criticism and moving towards self-compassion is definitely a theme that we keep coming back to in the group.
Yeah, and Mark, it reminds me of what you were talking about earlier with turning down the thought, and literally, and just thinking about it in terms of like noise decibel, how do we turn this down? And so I would love to hear, how have you been able to apply these skills in your own experience?
Yeah, the dimmer switch, again, I've been able to use that to turn down the voices of those people on the figurative bus.
Yeah.
And through some of the other exercises, like Dr. Pinto mentioned, I have been more aware of how I treat other people versus how I treat myself. And as a result, I'm kinder to myself. Yet this specific topic of self-criticism, self-compassion is an area I'm actively working on. Just this past week in my individual therapy, discussed many of these same things. And like the progress I've seen in other areas, I am confident that I can make progress here, but this is the work in progress area for me.
And you know what? You're not alone. Like OCP here and that, for I'm sure so many of us listening, I can speak for myself and say we're usually our hardest critics. And so giving ourselves some compassion and grace and going, the way we talk to ourselves is not the way we would dare talk to so many other people. And so that is a really important lesson that I think all of us could benefit from working on. And so kudos to you for doing that hard work. And I would say even from where we started the discussion, where you were talking about that you have choices, Mark, I think that's probably one of the most self-compassionate things we can allow ourselves to have, is to realize that we do have a choice and it doesn't have to be all. Immediately, the weight can come off the chest of like, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this, to go, I don't have to do this or that. I'm going to choose to do this here. I don't have to do this over here. That choice is huge. I love that. And so, Isabel, when we think about the willingness, and I love how Mark is modeling that he is willing to approach this and work on this. But I imagine willingness can be, again, a struggle. That self-critical voice, is this being selfish? How do you help people figure out and work with this idea of willingness?
Yeah. So willingness is another concept that we borrow from acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. And we really define it in our groups as openness to experiencing discomfort, unpleasant thoughts, feelings, sensations, whatever it might be, when we're going about making a behavior change or working towards our goals or pursuing our values. And we talk a lot about how willingness is required for this treatment. Many of these behavior changes are associated with self-criticism that's going to come up, with discomfort, with unpleasant sensations, anxiety, might notice changes in your mood temporarily. So we really encouraged our members to anticipate ahead of time what is going to come up for them when they're going about making these behavior changes. And so what that oftentimes looks like is we will ask a person to identify what thoughts do you think are going to come up? What sensations are going to come up? What feelings? What self-criticism? And can you make that active choice ahead of time to tolerate that for the value or the goal that you decided on? So essentially saying to themselves, I am willing here and now to tolerate X, Y, and Z in the short term, because in the long term, it's going to bring me closer to this value or this goal. But it really comes back to this decision or this question of choice and making an active choice.
Yeah. And I like the idea, like it takes the abstract and makes it concrete when we kind of even think of like budgeting, like, am I willing to spend this little here to be able to have this to spend here? And so if I'm sad because I feel like I don't have time to date, or I'm not getting to have the value of spending time with my family, then am I willing to turn down the noise over here to be able to increase over here? And so, yeah, that is hard. How do you choose? I would imagine that's one of the tricky spots, especially towards the beginning of treatment, of like, okay, or sometimes our values change and they shift and they morph. And so realizing that these dimmer switches don't have to be in a stuck position, we can actively be in a process of moving them, right?
It's a little bit of, like you were saying, kind of a cost-benefit analysis. And we also really do focus on the values piece in the long term there. Like when you're at your 100th birthday, are you going to want to say like, oh, I tolerated the discomfort of leaving the dishwasher packed incorrectly? Or am I going to rather have said that I spent a lot of time with my family? Like really focusing on what is going to be in the long term more worthwhile.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And so, Mark, how has this looked for you, the idea of willingness and kind of, I don't know, like making those decisions on where to compromise in one area to enhance in another area?
Yeah, both the individual and group therapy, the little experiments, or behavioral experiments or games have been helpful to see how I can tolerate discomfort on things that don't really make a difference in the larger picture, like leaving a dirty dish in the sink overnight or other things kind of similarly relatively not important in the bigger picture, but cause discomfort at the moment. And those have allowed me to have more confidence when I'm making choices about larger things that do have more of an impact on how I'm spending my time in alignment with my values. And so those have helped me like build that muscle and know that, oh, I can handle a little bit of discomfort here in order to put my energy over on this other thing.
Yeah.
Like one thing that has come up in group that I can relate to is when sending an email or something, just the need for it to be perfect and to proofread it, you know, 45 times and come back to it a couple hours later and read it again. And so I remember one homework assignment I chose was to just send emails in a more efficient manner. And if there were spelling errors or something wasn't clear, that was okay.
Yeah. Those are great examples. And I love the idea of what you said with building that muscle, because it does take practice, right? And I'm not a gym aficionado. Okay, I go from time to time. But if you go and lift something new, even if you're like helping a friend move, and anybody I'm sure can relate to that, you lift something, you feel sore the next day, and you're like, gosh, yeah, that was hard. But then if you were to keep at it or you were to continue with that, that soreness doesn't stick around to that same level of intensity, because you are really learning to work that muscle. And it is different the more you practice. And so I love that example. And, you know, Mark was talking, Anthony, about these behavioral experiments. And this part of the treatment, would love for you to share with the fam here a little more about what these behavioral experiments are designed to do and how they can help.
Sure. So the core, I mean, we talked a lot about all the different aspects of the therapy, whether it's individual or group, but the core of it is going to be experiential learning, like learning based on trying things in a different way. And so when it comes to trying brand new behaviors, we'll think about it in the frame of willingness that Isabel described. When it comes to rethinking ways that I currently do things that may not be the most efficient, then a behavioral experiment makes sense. So a behavioral experiment, for those that treat OCD or have been treated for OCD, think of it as like a mini exposure, but it's really conducted like you would conduct an experiment. You first of all, identify what is the belief or the rule or the standard that you're going to test. And then you craft an experiment to try a new way of doing that thing. And so you'll ask the person, what do you think will happen if you don't proofread the email? And then you actually set up a context in which they do it. And ideally, they would do it in the session, whether it's an individual or a group. And then you have them talk about what did you learn from that and how can you apply a new way of doing that. So group is a great place to do these experiments because the experiments can actually be done live in the group. So whenever we can, we'll try to do them live. If we can't, we'll have them planned and then committed to so that they could be revisited the following week.
I love that. And so you get to test it out in real time. And as you were saying, Mark, then you're able to understand the results in real time. Like, gosh, yes, that maybe felt uncomfortable, but did somebody come back and be like, you idiot, why didn't you spend more time on this email? Obviously, that showed through. No, you probably never got even a blink at it. And so is there one that sticks out in your mind, Mark, that you would be willing to share where you're like, you tested it and you were like, oh, that was a surprise result?
Yeah, I think early on, the one that sticks out for me is the dirty dishes in the sink. Like with kids, there's lots of dishes. And with bedtime, doing those dishes gets tricky because we want to get our kids to bed early, but we also want to get the dishes done, but I have more work to do. And there are a number of things demanding our time. And before I would go to bed, regardless of what time it was, I would make sure that all the dishes were done. And just that relatively simple thing of leaving a dirty dish in the sink overnight was very impactful. But I mean, we don't have a sink full of dirty dishes now as a result.
Right.
But I'm able to dim that, like turn that need down to get ready for bed myself and get more sleep. So I'm more able to fill that gas tank up. And then if there's three forks and two plates in the sink in the morning, it's okay.
Yeah, right. Because you're living in service then to a bigger need at the time, right? Like, yes, in a perfect world, there would be nothing in the sink. But also, I need the sleep or I'm going to be feeling like a grumpy bear tomorrow. And so I need to get this rest. And also, I don't know about you guys, but once the kids are in bed, I'm like, I want to have a glass of wine and just veg. I've had a full day at that point. So this is a great time to you know, binge watch something or just do nothing. Read a book, like you said earlier, Mark, have that time to read a book. And so what are you in service to? Are you in service to recharging that battery, refueling your tank? I love that. And so we're coming to a close, but I know that there are so many great resources that are coming about. But even before we get to that, we know there's so few programs. There's more people, one in 15, than there are resources. And so what are you hoping to see happen here and kind of a short-term goal in the field, Anthony, in terms of awareness growing and understanding growing for OCPD warriors?
Yeah, I think, like you said, the need exceeds the availability. And so what our purpose today was to describe the components of treatment that can be helpful so that clinicians trained in CBT could consider extending their services to those with OCPD, perhaps consider the feasibility of running an OCPD group. To our knowledge, the groups that we have at Northwell are the only ones of this kind. And we are, you know, one of the only specialized programs in OCPD, but that doesn't mean it can't exist elsewhere. And so I would encourage clinicians out there to consider a service like this, to get consultation, of course, if this is a new area for them, but, you know, to do some screening of participants in their practices to see who this service might be most relevant for. Perhaps start with a support group that could then be extended eventually to a treatment group that's clinician-led. But the goals here are to raise awareness, to provide more training for clinicians in terms of identification and treatment of OCPD, to work on self-help strategies, to put some of these tools more directly in the hands of people with OCPD who maybe don't have access at all in their geographic areas. So I think there's just a lot to do. We're motivated. We want partners in this work, and we appreciate your partnership, Nicole. We're going to mention again OCPD.org that has access to a support group that's available to anyone worldwide. If anyone wants more information, they can go to our website at Northwell Health. It's a Northwell Health OCD Center. We offer services, both individual and group therapy for OCD and OCPD, and we are in network for most insurance plans, including Medicare and Medicaid.
Which, that's huge. Medicare and Medicaid, finding programs that can take some of the government-run programs is such a challenge, because a lot of times the only option is out of pocket, because not a lot of people are in network. So I love that you guys are in network for that. But it just shows the need, right, guys? It shows the need. 1 in 15. I mean, we think about how common something like a body-focused repetitive behavior is, 1 in 20. This is even more common. It's even more common. And I know, just thinking about my own practice, but I'm sure so many therapists, if they really looked over their caseload, they could go, oh my gosh, I'm realizing OCPD is present within more of my OCD patients than I have previously realized or identified.
Or maybe it was mischaracterized as OCD.
Yes, such an important point. And, you know, one of the things as we just say our final goodbyes, and I know you talked a little bit earlier, Mark, about your family, your wife noticing a difference. She was the one that came to you and she was like, this is you, babe, look at this. But would love to hear how the family and how people can best support their warriors going through treatment, or maybe not even in treatment yet. What is something that you would want family members to know and understand about people with lived experience of OCPD?
That's a great question. My wife has been very supportive. I mean, from a time perspective, it's been, you know, an hour and 45 minutes to 2 hours of time per week on average that I've dedicated to individual and group therapy. So from that standpoint, I'm grateful for her support there. And I think for me, similar to the feeling that I wasn't alone when I learned about it, just having those discussions with family members and acknowledging, like, hey, this is who I've been. I've been making choices based on these things I didn't think I had a choice in. And together working through that. I know, even from the first day of individual therapy, just discussing things with my wife after each meeting, it's been helpful to our relationship. And sharing the homework assignments I'm going to do or the behavioral experiments, she's been supportive and hasn't made fun of the seemingly smallness of a, like, leaving dirty dishes in the sink. She's been supportive of those little things.
Yeah. And which are big things. They are big. They seem little, but they're big, right?
Totally.
Yeah. So if I'm hearing you correctly, it's about that communication. Like, be willing to communicate. Sometimes you probably receive a lot of feedback about, as we all in our partner relationship, what we're not doing right or how we're annoying other people or whatnot. But having some proactive communication about the process, what you're learning, and celebrating those wins. It's so important to be seen, to be understood. And so it's not a matter of, gosh, you've got to stop doing this, this, and this. It's, gosh, I have a choice between this, this, and this. And that choice is going to give me more freedom to be present here. and everybody rooting that process on. And so I think, too, I would imagine Anthony and Isabel would love to hear from you, but I would imagine, too, for family members surrounding, whether it's adult children or spouses, other people, roommates, maybe even if you're feeling this pent-up frustration or anxiety or distress, getting your own support and your own help. This person is working really hard on all the choices they're sifting through. And so getting your own support or your own therapy can sometimes be even helpful so that you have some more constructive tools to be able to communicate with your loved one.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think support for loved ones is really important. Therapy services for the loved ones can be really helpful just in terms of how, getting the support for managing the stress that can be present in households when OCPD is present, helping to manage boundaries, especially for those that are more the controlling type, and helping the family member to exercise healthier boundaries when somebody might be criticizing them, but also support for those where the loved one is presenting with this more anxious type to come up with strategies for helping them. Yeah, I think that group that I mentioned via OCPD.org is open to family members as well. So that can be a real starting point for getting education and learning ways to support.
I love that. Isabel?
Yeah, I'll just add that. I mean, I think we mentioned, but just to really emphasize this point, that oftentimes the impairment people see with OCPD is also in their relationship functioning. So it's not uncommon for people to see that OCPD has gotten in the way of their romantic relationships, their friendships, their family relationships. And so, yes, I would say it's huge to have that support for people who are in those relationships, both to figure out how to support that person's individual treatment and also to kind of manage the relationship stress more effectively overall.
I think that's such a great point. Well, you guys, we have used every last strip of time. This has been absolutely fantastic. And what a wonderful panel. I thank you, Anthony. I thank you, Isabel. And Mark, I love and just so appreciate the gift of you sharing your story, because you're not alone. And I'm glad that you know you're not alone. But I know that there are listeners out there going, oh my gosh, it's like you could have been in my head. I get it. And for those folks going, there's not something wrong with me, but I actually have some choice. There's hope for me. That is such a beautiful thing. And so I thank you all for your time and just really appreciate you guys hanging out with the fam.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Nicole. This was once again great to have you host us, and so glad that we were able to talk through OCPD. I want to thank Isabel, who's been a phenomenal partner in running this group. And she's, I think, going to be a future star in terms of a clinical psychologist. And Mark, I can't thank you enough. I think hearing from you is going to help so many people. So really appreciate you being here today.
Yeah. Intrusive thoughts. All right, fam. All right. How fantastic was that? I mean, how lucky are we with this incredible conversation? It's so helpful. So I just want to thank my amazing panel again with my esteemed friend, Dr. Anthony Pinto, for starters. Anthony, I definitely think we achieved all of the goals for helping people understand OCPD better. And I appreciate your dedication to our field. And Isabel, you are a rock star, I will say. I've interviewed many, many guests over the years, and you do have a special quality to not only your knowledge, but your poise and your ability to articulate both support and guidance. I'm sure you are treasured at Northwell, and I'm excited to watch your career unfold for the betterment of our field. And then Mark. Oh, Mark. It takes so much bravery and vulnerability to share our stories with other people, let alone on a podcast like this. But I guarantee so many listeners will gain great value out of your transparency and your learning along the way. Your voice is going to make a big impact in destigmatizing this disorder and in embracing our personality strengths and the hope that can come in treatment. And for Mark's family, thank you too for supporting and hanging with Mark through the tougher times and the growth. We're all better together. And as Mark noted, particularly when it came to his beloved, you are such a great source of strength and support for him. So thanks again, everyone. And this brings us all to the Intrusive Thought segment, which is the application segment of my show for any newer family joining. It's that time where we take what we've heard and we figure out how we can apply it here and now. So for today, I'm going to lean into that idea of self-compassion, and I'm going to ask for all of us how we address those other passengers in our head. Whether you struggle with OCPD or not, how do you talk to yourself? Do you correct and recalibrate in value-driven ways, or do you criticize or even shame? And how would we direct that same feedback to our spouse or partner, maybe our mother or a child, maybe even our boss versus ourselves? Because something tells me we all could benefit from practicing more kindness, compassion, and grace for ourselves. Family, we are all working so hard in so many different ways. So let's remind ourselves that we're pretty Riz, no cap, even if we don't exactly know what that means. And also, let's remember to look around, because we're not alone in this. None of us. And we are better together. Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like Mark, Isabel, Anthony, and me talking about OCPD. That's right. I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, are your clients struggling with disgust-based contamination OCD? Have you tried upgrading your ERP with the Mastery approach? Visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses and click on my link because I've got just the training for you. At OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses, you can check out OCD Training School's entire catalog of courses, including Rich Gallagher's course, Treating Contamination OCD. Where else can you build mastery over disgust-based triggers while supporting the fam at no extra cost to you? It's a win-win at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses.